frosting to 36. It is 26 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. Wind chill 11 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Famous Nordic choir under the direction of Weston Noble, singing at the so-called Bach Church, St. Thomas Kirche in Leipzig, Germany, on tour in the summer of 1967. Today would be the 100th birthday of Weston Noble, who led the Nordic choir at Luther College, his alma mater, for more than half a century. I want to begin today's morning show by honoring the 100th birthday of Weston Noble by playing a brief excerpt from a memorable conversation which I recorded with him on the morning show during the year that he served as interim director of choral activities at Carthage College. This is a portion of the interview in which Weston Noble is looking back at his early life and at a very crucial turning point.
After the Second World War, where does life take you?
Life was all set for me to go to the Juilliard School of Music in New York because I was accepted, and I was packing in the morning to take the noon train to become a student at Juilliard, and all of a sudden I sat down the side of the bed and I said to myself, I just can't pack. I guess I'm not going. So I went downstairs and I said, Mom, I'm not going to Juilliard. What? You're not going to Juilliard? No. What are you going to do? I'm going to pick up the Des Moines Register and find a high school that needs a music teacher. And I ended up teaching a little high school. The total enrollment was 93, and 75 of the 93 were in the mixed chorus.
Wow.
And I was there, had the band and the choir and the English literature class, and never had English literature. That's the way they did. And I stayed there 2 years.
And where was there? Was that in Iowa someplace?
Yeah, it's just it's a little tiny town in north central Iowa. Yeah.
Have you ever stopped to try to sort out what happened on that morning in terms of what held you back from going to Juilliard?
Oh, absolutely. If I had gone, I would have gone out there and been so disillusioned because who's ever heard of the choir at Juilliard? I wouldn't have been getting any training in my field at all. I wouldn't have been preparing myself to teach students in a high school. And I just know that there was somebody who had a hand on my shoulder and said, young chap, this is not where you're supposed to be now. You're supposed to go out and find out how to work with students in a small school. You're supposed to go out and teach. And, of course, that was exactly right.
Now, if we could step back in a time machine and be a fly on the wall and watch you in action with those first choir rehearsals as a young man in that little high school, what would we have seen? Would we have seen very impressive work that would have knocked our socks off?
I wonder what you would have seen, Greg. I'm not sure. I know you had seen someone who's very enthusiastic. First rehearsal, I got three chords in tune, and that was it. And I just thought I would reach the moon. Oh, my goodness sakes. No, I think you had seen somebody who was very, very romantic in his approach to things. And I had a guest clinician come in once, and after the clinic, he came up to me and he said, "Weston, you're just all over the place. You got to get yourself focused, you know." So I was retarding here and, you know, all the excesses. Well, you eventually start to grow out of that and become a little bit more cerebral. But at the time. But I know that I was enthusiastic, and I think that's what the students caught, and I think that's why we had a good time together.
Now, did you head from that tiny high school back to Luther? Is there another step in the chain?
My, you're certainly asking the right questions, Greg. I decided that I would quit teaching and go back to school and get my master's degree, and so I chose the University of Michigan. Went out there, was enrolled in my third summer school, and got my apartment, got a roommate and everything. This offer came from Luther to teach for 1 year for the replacement of the man who had suddenly, his wife had gotten a job at New York City Center Opera. And so here I was offered this place to teach. And I went around and asked every single teacher what I should do. What do you think they said, yes or no? Yes to go or no not to go? What do you think they said?
Oh, that's a good question. Depends on how generous of spirit they were.
Every single one of them said no. Stay here.
Yeah, I would think it would have been hard to let you go, and they probably were fearful for you too.
Yeah. Then on Friday afternoon, I had a piano lesson, and I asked my piano teacher. She says, "What's your goal in life?" I said, "I want to teach in college." "Well, for goodness sakes, take this job, get it on your record, and be ahead of everybody else." Man, I ran so fast for that phone to call Luther and say, "I'll come for a year." And, of course, I like to think, boy, was it a long year.
Over half a century you were there.
Yeah, 57 years.
What did it feel like to be back on that campus not all that long after you had been a student there? And of course, you're not the first person in history to go through that, but I should think that would have been interesting.
It was interesting because in the first choir I had at Luther, the first Nordic choir I had at least a half a dozen GIs, you know, and they were practically my same age.
Mm.
But somehow they showed me the right respect and things moved along.
If we would compare the way you conducted choirs and led rehearsals and interacted with students, is the Weston Noble of 1948 profoundly different from the Weston Noble of 2007, or at least in the most essential ways, were you very much the same person then as you are now?
That's quite a question. I can answer it one way, in this manner. After about my third year at Luther, I was asked to lecture on any topic I wanted to the State Convention of the Wisconsin Music Educators. So I chose the topic of the psychology that's involved in having a good rehearsal. What right psychological steps can contribute to a fine rehearsal? And Greg, to this day, I go back to that lecture that I wrote.
Huh.
So, and then that I have not changed. I'm sure that I'm much more academic now, so to speak. I have much more knowledge, and I'm probably not quite as wild, so to speak, you know, in my emotional outbursts and so forth. But the kernel part of it was there. It was just letting the plant grow. Yeah.
Coral legend Weston Noble, in an interview I recorded with him for the morning show back in 2007, during the year he served Carthage College as interim director of choral activities. Weston Noble passed away in 2016. Today would have been his 100th birthday. I'm going to share this interview in its entirety in the podcast version of the morning show this weekend. For part two of today's morning show, you're going to hear the interview I just recorded yesterday with Dr. Susan J. Noonan, a physician-certified peer specialist and consultant to Massachusetts General Hospital, and the author of a new book called Reconnecting After Isolation, Coping with Anxiety, Depression, Grief, PTSD, and More, a book which she wrote primarily with the after effects of the COVID-19 pandemic in mind and the unwanted isolation which so many people experienced for extended periods of time, isolation which some people are still experiencing. The book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. I wanted to ask you about something we see at the very beginning of the book, in essentially the inside back cover. Just a brief little note to the reader when you say this book is not meant to substitute for medical care of people who have depression or other mental disorders, and treatment should not be based solely on its contents. I really appreciate the fact that you say that. I mean, many books like this will sometimes say that in more or less, but it's not always stated quite as clearly and forthrightly as you stated here. How do you want people to utilize this book, and why is it important for them not to use it in the way set out in that reader's note?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. So all of our lives are full of ups and downs and different stressors. And most of the time we can manage them on their own. Sometimes we need help from our friends or family who can support us. I'd like people to use this book as a way to educate themselves about the various mental health consequences that can arise following a period of isolation. That could be from the pandemic or from other causes, such as being home for a couple of months with a broken leg or a difficult pregnancy, for example. And to educate themselves, to learn some self-help techniques, and then to realize when it is important for them to reach out and receive professional mental health treatment, whether that's from your primary care physician or from a mental health professional, to have a better understanding of when it's necessary and important to obtain that kind of help. Dealing with a mental health issue requires some effort and work on the part of the person. So this offers some tips and practical advice on that that could be alone or in addition to professional help. Hmm.
One of the things that you spell out in your book that I think is a really important point, and it kind of underscores, in a sense, sort of the irony of some of this, is you say at one point, being alone for short periods can be restorative and helpful. But unintentional or involuntary isolation often has a very negative effect on our emotional health. That's such a curious thing. I mean, in a sense, there's a problem when we're never alone, when we never have time just to ourselves. That time to ourselves can be so important, a healthy part of one's life. What is it that tilts that being alone from being helpful and restorative to being detrimental to our well-being?
That's a great question. Well, spending some time alone each day without feeling lonely has a purpose. And it's often soothing and restorative. It provides us a sense of peace and renewal and allows us to think some and self-reflect and replenish ourselves. That's really important when we're alone. And this is something that we choose to experience rather than enforced or involuntary isolation of something like the pandemic or a mental illness or a major life disruption. So going for a quiet walk outside, for example, in nature, or meditation, or prayer, or art, or music, for example, or a favorite hobby. The problem arises when we're in a situation where, in fact, we are isolated from others, and it's not necessarily by our choice. We're designed to be social beings and wired to seek out contact with other people and relationships. We've kind of drifted away from that when we no longer live in small villages and we live in large cities, for example. And our lives are affected by different disruptions and transitions, sometimes medical events, or race and cultural issues can be isolating, or previous health or mental health conditions. And all of these can contribute, but it can have a negative effect on our health, both our mental health as well as our physical health. And we need to be able to adjust to these changes in our daily lives to try to minimize, if not avoid, those from occurring. Mm.
I really appreciate that observation you make early in the book about how, even apart from the COVID-19 pandemic, that already in just sort of modern life, particularly here in America, we are seeing rising levels of seclusion and loneliness. And of course, part of what is also ironic about that is that in many cases, we're talking about people living in gigantic cities, other urban centers. So it's not that there aren't people around or even people really close to us sort of geographically, and yet one can live in a setting like that and feel terribly lonely, terribly secluded, and not just during pandemics, but I mean, it really underscores how loneliness, isolation, has, in a sense, many different faces.
Yes, it does. We can feel lonely in a crowd. We can feel lonely on a crowded train, or busy shopping center, for example, if for some reason we feel apart or cut off from other people, or we don't have anybody who seems to know us well, or we can't connect on that deeper level. So there are some people where the reverse is true. They can live what looks like a solitary life. Maybe it's a fisherman out to sea or a long-haul truck driver, and they don't have as much social contact as others, and perhaps they don't feel lonely because it fits their needs, their particular style and preferences, and they have enough social contact to sustain them. So in a sense, it's individualized, but in fact, the feeling of isolation and loneliness can happen when you're in a crowd.
Hmm. So your book, of course, goes on to explore some of the ways in which enforced or unwanted social isolation can really affect us in detrimental ways, including, of course, the biggie, depression, which is something that we so easily misunderstand. One of the things I want to ask you about depression within this context is that sometimes we think about depression as or anxiety as being sad or worried about things. And of course, especially during the height of the COVID pandemic, there were all kinds of things to be worried about or sad about. And I should think it's very tricky to figure out what is the difference between that, between understandable sadness or fear and sadness and fear when it crosses a line and becomes something like clinical depression or anxiety.
Yeah, that's sometimes hard to tell on ourselves. Sometimes other people are more observant, but it reflects any changes from our baseline self that actually persist. So that could be irritability, for example, or anger, or having variations in our sleep or our diet or our routines. Anything that persists and then starts to interfere with our lives and our ability to function in our lives at school or work or socially, that's when it's time to pay attention and potentially get professional help. Ideally, a mental health specialist, but a primary care physician can also treat the early stages of this. And they'll help with the psychological and emotional problems, any distortions in thinking, any behaviors that have become troublesome, and so you can learn to cope, understand things better, learn healthy ways to manage the stress that's all around us and make sound decisions and adjust to the life losses and transitions that we're all experiencing right now.
One thing that may come as a surprise to some people is the presence in your book of fatigue and the fact that that often is, first of all, a common symptom of depression and something that can arise from extended social isolation. And it just sort of seems kind of strange because so often we think of fatigue, of being tired from, being tired after exertion. I mean, kind of an obvious extended exertion of one kind or another, but especially physical exertion. And just the idea that somebody living in social isolation could experience fatigue is kind of strange. And yet, of course, it's undeniable. Explain how isolation can lead to fatigue and what one can do about it.
That's great. I mean, isolation can affect so many areas of our lives. And with fatigue being one of them, it can happen with other mental illnesses like depression or anxiety, for example, and can be a core symptom in those. But it's something that can affect us physically, such as we don't have energy, you know, our arms and legs feel heavy, and we feel physically exhausted and can't tolerate walking up the stairs, for example. But it could also be mental fatigue, difficulty thinking and concentrating, and maybe we just don't feel sharp. And we can have emotional fatigue, where we just feel apathetic and just not interested anymore in anything, and kind of weary of life and things in general. For example, a decreased interest in things. So it can come from a number of different things. It can come from mental illness. It can come from medications. It can come from being isolated, where we're kind of lulled into the sense of, oh, we don't have to get dressed. No, we can do Zoom in our pajama bottoms and our sweat clothes. No, we don't have to go out to the supermarket or the pharmacy. We can get that delivered after we order it online. And things like that kind of lull us into this false sense that we can get through life, but it's without the flavor of life.
Interesting. Your book in that same section goes on to talk about burnout as one type of fatigue and something that's often associated with the workplace, although I'm sure one can certainly feel burnout from just maybe being a parent in a challenging situation or whatever. And I really found interesting kind of the array of different definitions that you gave about what this is. I think my favorite is someone who said, burnout is the impact of chronic exposure to emotionally draining environments. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, some of us are blessed to work in settings where we are, at least for the most part, energized and uplifted versus other work environments which are just the opposite and which leave us terribly depleted. What kinds of things have we seen, especially during this period of the COVID-19 pandemic, around this particular phenomenon?
Oh, around burnout. Well, burnout, when you think of it with the idea of stress, stress can differ from many of us. What makes you feel stressed might be different from the next person. Or what makes you feel stressed on one day might be different on another day if there are other cumulative factors that go into it. That's why I like the definition that you pointed to, which is emotionally draining environments. So that could be related to a work situation. There are fewer employees, for example. Maybe people have been laid off. Perhaps they've changed the routine and your department is smaller. You're carrying a heavier load. And it's hard to say no. Your work life has expanded. If you're working from home and you have to resist the temptation to answer emails at 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock at night. You have to balance and juggle raising a family, perhaps, with homeschooling, but also making sure that you attend to the other aspects of healthy development, such as getting exercise, interacting with your peer group, playtime, for example, and you're all managing that. And over a while, that can just become particularly exhausting and hard to juggle and makes one feel overwhelmed. Mm. So in the pandemic, lots of different things can contribute to this. It's a matter of being able to identify that that's actually happening at the moment and be able to take some steps to try and control it and manage it better.
Right. I found that during the height of the pandemic, I mean, my life actually became drastically simpler since I was, in addition to my work, I'm also a singer and a musician. And of course, public performances ground to a halt, of course. And so in a sense, it shouldn't have been all that stressful a time. And yet I ended up losing some of the things that feed me most and had to find other ways to do that and experience that kind of sustenance. So it's just interesting the different shapes that this takes. Your book also talks about something that I actually hadn't really heard of before, but it makes so much sense, something called re-entry anxiety, that when certain people emerge from the sort of the depths or the heights of the COVID pandemic and are, in a sense, re-entering something resembling normal life, normal function, that in and of itself can be a great source of anxiety. What is your suggestion for people who might be experiencing re-entry anxiety?
It is a pretty common thing, probably perhaps more than we think. The world we live in now is different. And we have a new set of needs and a new set of rules and expectations associated with that. We also have to recognize, to begin with, that any level of discomfort that we have experienced is valid, that it's okay. So to begin, you have to decide what boundaries, what activities that you and your family want to adopt and what you're comfortable with. Think of it with your own pace and make this transition back into the work or school or social world at your own pace. And that can take time. It can be a gradual thing. Don't worry about what other people are doing and don't feel pressured by them. You might have to say, yeah, I've decided to keep more of a distance right now. That's what I'm comfortable doing. I hope you understand. Something like that. You have to base any of these decisions on reliable information, not the 24/7 media feed that we might get with some uncertainties and distortions, perhaps. And as a part of all this, we have to set our expectations for what's realistic here and now and grieve the losses that we might have had associated with this period of isolation, not just the loss of a loved one, for example, but loss of perhaps our health status, loss of our pre-pandemic life and lifestyle, that things are different now. Maybe loss of employment or the way we see our previous job or our current job. Perhaps loss of opportunities or milestones in life, like graduations and weddings. And then, of course, financial losses, loss of our personal financial stability. And most people will be able to deal with this and with the anxiety associated with it and make the transition. However, if it becomes excessive and interferes with a person's ability to function in life, then it's time to pay attention and seek some professional help. Mm.
Well, your book certainly outlines all of that and more, including very specific possibilities in terms of pursuing the kind of help that can really make a difference. The book, again, is titled Reconnecting After Isolation, Coping with Anxiety, Depression, Grief, PTSD, and More, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. The author, Dr. Susan J. Noonan. Dr. Noonan, thank you so much for giving the world this book and for giving me some of your time to be part of the morning show today. I really appreciate it. Best wishes.
Thank you. I'd just like to mention that people can reach out to me and contact me to my website at SusanNoonanMD.com, and they can message me, and I will respond promptly, and they can see my blogs and links to the book if they need to.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Steve Phillips, who is a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian, and the author of a really interesting book before this called Brown is the New White, and a new book called How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. The wording of that title is no accident. It is the contention of Steve Phillips, and he is not alone in saying it, is that in many respects, we are still waging, still fighting the Civil War that, of course, officially only took place and officially ended back in 1865. But in the minds of many, that war has never ended, and that there are those who still fervently and ardently believe in the causes of the Confederacy and are at work against on those causes to this very day. And that's one of the things that he explores in his really interesting book. And I'm really glad that we have Steve Phillips with us for the next few minutes to talk about his book, again titled How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Steve Phillips, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Before we get into the book, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about an organization that you helped to create called Democracy in Color. I think it touches very directly on many of the issues that you raise in your book. So tell us briefly about Democracy in Color.
So Democracy in Color is a media organization that provides information and analysis with a color-conscious perspective. Right? We have a podcast, Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. We have a color-conscious podcast about politics. We have a weekly newsletter, which is a roundup of information and things we're reading and analysis about the changing demographics in the country and how they're playing themselves out in U.S. politics. And we do different reports periodically about U.S. politics from a very race-conscious lens. We did an analysis of the spending of the Democratic super PACs in 2020, that type of a thing. So, but the core products we put out into the world are our biweekly podcast and our weekly newsletter.
I'm really glad that you used the turn of phrase that you did, because it prompts a question that I'm not sure I would have thought to ask. When we hear from certain people on the right, when it comes to some of these issues, they will lodge the charge that those on the left are actually overly preoccupied with matters of race. And they will sometimes even go so far as to accuse the other side of racism, or maybe racism in reverse, by being so preoccupied, or as you yourself use the phrase, color conscious. How would you respond to those concerns or charges? And do you see any potential pitfalls in being color conscious as you are grappling with various issues?
No, not at all. That the introduction to my current book is titled Choice Between Democracy and Whiteness. And it's a phrase that the historian Taylor Branch used in describing the rise of white domestic terrorism under Trump. And he was talking about how, so people would not stand for being a minority in their own country. The question is, if given a choice between democracy and whiteness, how many would choose whiteness? And that's exactly what transpired on January 6, 2021, whereas that all 50 governors of the state, every state in this country, had said that the election was over and certified the results, and the results were that Joe Biden had won. That's democracy. And then you had people carrying the Confederate flag, wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War January 6, 2021, storming the United States Capitol. And so, and hurling racist epithets at many of the black police officers who were trying to defend the Capitol. And so this struggle over whether this is fundamentally a white country or whether or not this is a multiracial country continues to this day. And if you look at the challenges that we face in this country, most fundamentally, the profound gargantuan racial wealth gap, where the average white family has more than 10 times the assets of the average black and Latino family, and everything that flows from that in terms of housing and education and job opportunities, et cetera, that's all quite racialized within this country. And so we have profound racial inequality. And my first book, Brown's the New White, I talk about why do white people have all the money? And that if you look basically at, they came to this country, took the country, brought people over here to work the country and create its wealth, and then took it and kept it for themselves. That's the origins of the contemporary racial wealth gap we have. So if we're going to have a society of equality and justice and the values that, you know, we like to espouse rhetorically, we have to grapple with the profound racial inequality, which is racial and economic inequality, which is government created and protected and extended. We've only had non-legal racism and discrimination has only been illegal in this country since 1964, in the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. Prior to that, it was perfectly legal to discriminate in hiring and jobs in all of these different areas until the Civil Rights Act of 64 was passed, which was the year I was born. So we are dealing with these issues, and you can't then walk into a situation of such profound inequality and say, we're not going to talk about it.
Right. I was going to say,
perpetuates it.
And it's easy to say, let's not talk about race when you are white and living in the midst of a society in which so much of the power and so much of the wealth resides with you and other whites. It's one thing for somebody like that to say, let's not talk about race. I think that's part of what you're saying.
Oh, 100%. That we live in a society that there is profound inequality that benefits white people, that every white person inherits, and you're not going to change it unless you talk about it. But those who don't want it to change don't want it to be talked about. So that's actually not a very surprising thing at all. And that's part of what, you know, I see my mission as, is trying to get this word out into the world, get people to face these realities, and then point a path to how we change them.
I'm speaking with Steve Phillips, author of How We Win the Civil War. I want to take a moment to talk about the really interesting author's note at the front of your book, in which you you talk first about the choice of when you refer to someone by a first name versus referring to them by their last name, and kind of the different sort of gesture of respect which, you know, one choice versus the other might represent. And then a really interesting point where you talk about the matter of capitalizing the word blacks versus the word whites. Let's talk about the first. I thought this was really quite interesting. First names and last names, and it says so much about thinking about respect with others. Can you just quickly tell our listeners what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, particularly with people of color, particularly women of color, particularly most strictly African-American women, and actually Martin Luther King references this in his letter from a Birmingham jail, about people are not accorded the respect of being called, you know, Mr. or Ms. or by their last name, and it's a form of disrespect historically in terms of how people have been talked about, particularly people of color. And so I was very sensitive to that, and I didn't want to perpetuate that reality in my book. At the same time, as I wanted people to feel a bond and a sense of affection with the leaders who, particularly the ones who I know and have a close relationship with, people like Stacey Abrams, people like Tran Nguyen in Virginia, I wanted them to bond with them. And so I grappled with that and defaulted to using their first names where I use their first names. I want to try to convey my own sense of, you know, affection, understanding, belief for these people, and have the readers embrace that as well.
Hmm. There's an interesting conversation there as well that we would leave to our listeners in which you talk about the choice to not capitalize the word whites, but capitalizing the word blacks. It's a very, very interesting point, and I'm glad it's there. Really, it got me thinking. Let's proceed, though, to kind of the heart and soul of the book, in which you, in effect, talk about what you call the Confederate battle plan. That is the strategy, official or not, that has been in place from the early days after the end of the Civil War, which, of course, again, you're suggesting has not really ended at all. I found this quite interesting, and one of the most important tenets of this so-called Confederate battle plan is what you call distorting public opinion. Sometimes we call that efforts towards disinformation. And you tell us that this is actually nothing new, that even in the early days after the Civil War, that there was a national disinformation campaign that was sophisticated, multidimensional, and far-reaching. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, very much so. And it continues, that campaign continues to this day. And so there was an effort to redefine what the Civil War was about and to sanitize what was, in essence, the most violent and bloody conflict in this country as an effort to do that would allow white people to continue to hold black people in chains and slavery. And so there was an effort to change the marketing around what the Civil War actually was about. And this whole notion of the lost cause was erected, and there was, books written, and then there was, and then that's what I think continues to this day. So the Gone with the Wind is a core example of this. Gone with the Wind, written by Margaret Mitchell, who was highly inspired by the author of a book called The Klansman that was the basis for the film Birth of a Nation. And she basically transformed the Civil War, which is a war about preserving slavery, into this romanticized story of this, dashing leading man and leading woman, and that captured the imagination of people. As recently as 2018, Gone with the Wind is like the sixth most popular book within this country. And so that's a very successful effort to redefine and to distort public opinion around what the Civil War itself was. So that's all predicate to then having the current Trump big lie around the 2020 election was stolen, et cetera, et cetera. But it shows the duration and the tenacity of ways to change public opinion, and it has been a consistent part of the Confederate battle plan.
Very recently, by the way, I happened to hear a recording of the remarks that Margaret Mitchell made at the official opening of the film of Gone with the Wind. She was the last to speak after various cast members, and in her remarks to this cheering crowd in, I think, Atlanta, she makes very specific reference to the Confederacy. And to the something like the beauty of the Confederacy or something, and it really was kind of shocking to me. I would have thought that any references to the Confederacy would have been sort of veiled or not nearly so overt. But she, it really underscored for me, yes, that there are at least certain Southerners who have a devotion for the Confederacy and for what the Confederacy stood for. That is very, very energetic and galvanized to this very day. In your book, you present, in a sense, a battle plan in reverse for those who would oppose the tenets of this so-called Confederate battle plan. Tell us what the heart and soul of your thoughts is in terms of what must be done to mount a effective counterplan to this Confederate battle plan.
Right. So the second half of the book is case studies of how we win and how we have been winning, looking at places like Georgia, Virginia, Arizona, Harris County, Texas, and San Diego, and what they have done to be able to make real progress in those areas that were former, many of them former Confederate strongholds. And so it was interesting that there's very consistent elements of what has taken place in each of those areas, and that's what I call the Confederate battle plan in terms of strong leaders, civic engagement groups, detailed data-driven plans, and playing the long game. And the essence of it, I would say, is about expanding democracy and civic participation. Because the fundamental point being, this is what I tried to outlay in my first book, is that there is a new American majority within this country consisting of the overwhelming majority of people of color, what I call a meaningful minority of whites. That's the coalition that elected Obama and reelected Obama. People of color have gone from 12% of the population in the 60s to 40% today. And so the challenge is, how do you translate that population majority into a electoral and political majority? And that's the fundamental imperative of this hour, and that's the core component of the Liberation Battle Plan, is to find the leaders and the groups and the people who have the plans to be able to get the population into the polls so that election results can be transformed. And that is how Biden won Georgia in a way that shocked him. And the title of my Georgia chapter is Georgia. That's not one we expected, because that's what Biden said on election night. And that's the fundamental. And you know it's the fundamental battle because the conservatives are doing everything they can to suppress voting and to make it as hard as possible to participate, because they understand the strategic significance of the of galvanizing the electorate. And that's the core of this battle plan piece, and that's the core of how we, in fact, do win.
You talk quite a lot in the book about various success stories, and you don't talk about anything as much as you talk about Georgia, of course. And we associate the name of Stacey Abrams with that success in Georgia. But you tell us that success was not just about Stacey. And that's probably one of the most important points that you're trying to make here. I mean, it is about particular gifted people and the huge difference that they make. But what about that success story in Georgia is beyond Stacey Abrams herself? What is the other takeaway from Georgia?
Yeah, no, I joked with Stacey when she called me in 2021 after the new Senate had passed the COVID relief bill. And I said, so you took that $10,000 we helped you raise and you turned it into $2 trillion for the American people? And she says, I'd like to provide return on investment. So the work that she did to transform the electorate, right? When I met Stacey 10 years ago, she said that do we lose by 200,000 votes? There are 1.5 million people of color who don't vote. I'm going to go register them to vote. And that is the work that led to Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff getting elected to the Senate, flipping control of the entire United States Senate, the entire United States Congress. So anything that has come out of this Senate and Congress that people think is good is due to the work that Stacey was doing for the past decade of transforming the electorate so that we could change who its leaders were in Congress, and that changed the whole balance of power in the entire country.
A last question. Both in the Confederate battle plan and in the counter plan, there is a tenet that is the same: play the long game. What does that mean to you, playing the long game?
It means sticking with it. And so in each of these places, I highlight leaders and groups who have been doing work to make change. And every single one of them, the same leaders and same groups have been at it for at least a decade. And they've stuck at that work around bringing people to the electorate, changing its composition, making sometimes often incremental gains, but tenacious and unrelenting. And so it means having a 10-year mindset in terms of going about this work and sticking with it through the ups and downs. Playing that long game is what yields the results.
The book, again, is How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. The author, Steve Phillips. Steve Phillips, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your thought-provoking book, and best wishes to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're approaching 9 o'clock here on WGTD, and tomorrow.